I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this Valentine's Day edition of Parallax Views, Greg Belvedere of the Rebel Base YouTube channel joins us to discuss his upcoming video on the term cuck, which used to refer to a fetish from which a man would become aroused seeing his partner have sex with another man, but has since become the favorite insult lobbed by the alt-right at men seen as weak and servile. Why is the alt-right so obsessed with this specific term, and what does it say about their fears and anxieties? Well, Greg has his own interesting take answering that very question. And so, with that being said, why don't we jump right into the conversation with Greg Belvedere of the Rebel Base YouTube channel on the fear of a cucked planet. Welcome to Parallax Views, Greg Belvedere of the Rebel Base YouTube channel, also a sometimes contributor to Current Affairs, and I believe you've also done some work with Zero Books.
Yes, that's correct. I did a kind of a pairing, a collaboration of video essays with them.
Maybe for my listeners that are unfamiliar with Rebel Base and your work, maybe you could just give a brief primer of sorts.
Yeah, I started my YouTube channel when Jordan Peterson started to become popular. I said, well, you know, I felt that somebody kind of needed to counter some blatantly wrong things he was saying, not just about leftist ideas, but even about, you know, spirituality and stuff. He got some very basic things wrong that aren't that hard. And so I started making videos about him, but obviously you can only make so many videos about Jordan Peterson. So I started to talk about topics that I'm very interested in, media and technology. I'm a former public librarian, so that's kind of like my wheelhouse, but also ecology. I'm very interested in eco-socialist ideas and kind of meeting ecofascism, by really addressing the issue of scarcity, which is something that I think that people on the left need to take seriously, even though if you deal with it the wrong way, it can kind of lead towards those more eco-reactionary, eco-fascist viewpoints.
You approached me to come on the show about, I don't know, is it an unfinished article or an article that you haven't gotten around to releasing yet?
Yeah, it was something that I shopped around. You know, one publisher was not interested, and then when I was looking for other places to put it out, I realized there wasn't, I don't know, I didn't think I could find anywhere that was a good fit. And it was one of those things where it could have been a very, you know, very long article or a short book, and really wasn't going to fit into the short form that gets published so much nowadays. So at the moment, I've taken the script that I have for it, and I'll probably make a video out of it, which is what I do with a lot of things that are not able to find a publisher for. So it's kind of it'll probably be a fairly long video once it's out. But I expect that to be out within the next, I don't know, 2 or 3 months. The script is almost done, but you know, lots of work to take care of.
And the topic of this article, now a future video for the Rebel Base channel, is a very popular, extremely online term, although I'm seeing people use it more in real life now, especially on college campuses. Although they usually don't know what the word actually means, I found out. And yeah. I'm talking about the rise of the word cuck in popular culture and extremely online culture.
Yeah, it's interesting how it has kind of popped up. I mean, I was a English major in college, and I feel like the only time I ever heard it was, you know, if you're reading Shakespeare or Chaucer, there was references to cuckolds, guys whose wives slept around or whatever. But it's strange because in, you know, the past couple of years, it's kind of gotten into the political discourse. Before that, you know, obviously it was in it was a porn subgenre, I guess you would say. And it's really been adopted by the alt-right, which is very interesting. I find it very telling because it says so much about their own insecurities. They're so insecure about losing out and so insecure about, you know, being cucked, whether that's literally or metaphorically. So much of like the cuckold porn is, you know, this interracial porn where there's a black guy and he's, you know, more endowed or more masculine, and he's sleeping with the wife while the white guy is in the corner and he's really pathetic. And it's very telling from that this slur became popular amongst the alt-right, because these are the people who are worried about, you know, like white birth rates and things like that. And then you have this, they're really telling on themselves, which is interesting.
I was going to say in that regard, when I first started seeing the term being used by the alt-right, my immediate reaction was just to sort of roll my eyes. And I'm like, they're way too obvious about their like kinks and hang-ups. but you are writing something that sort of takes this seriously. Why do you take that approach as to the approach that a lot of people have taken of, oh, look at these clowns. They're revealing their own perversions and claiming, you know, otherwise.
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on. I think at the end of the day, there are some problems with the nuclear family. I don't know if I just said that like George W., but there are some problems with it. There has some, you know, like I have a nuclear family. I love my nuclear family. But in today's economy and in today's social structure, you know, a job that used to be distributed amongst an extended family now falls on just two people. And so I definitely think there is a desire to break out of that and find other living arrangements, partially because it's uneconomical, partially because it's a lot of work, partially because it might not fit everyone's sexual dynamic. And so that's why I think it's interesting. especially as we have, like, you know, people worrying about incels. The way I kind of stumbled upon this and really got more interested in it was when I was speaking with Doug Lane from Zero Books about a year and a half ago, I think now. And we started talking about the problem of incels. Like, what do you do with all these guys that are sexually frustrated and are, can be a very dangerous force in society? What do you do about that? And he somewhat jokingly, but somewhat seriously said, you know, well, if you had a matriarchal society, or what I think you would call a polygynous society, a society where women have more than one husband, you would have, you know, more people would have intimacy in their lives, more men specifically would have intimacy in their lives. And, you know, there's some problems with that, but the general idea I started thinking of more. Now, he pointed out the problem with that is that we would all be cucks. And I think that is, in some ways, what is holding people back from making certain changes. And I think there is even a parallel there with, you know, economic changes. You know, if you have property and, you know, in the context of monogamous relationships, your partner kind of is your property. I mean, it grew out of that. It grew out of an agricultural setting where people were, you know, putting, you know, seeing their partners as property. So if you have that situation where you have property, you're afraid to lose it. And I think that's a big part of this anxiety that you see. You see it on the right, but I see it internally. I mean, I don't want somebody else sleeping with my wife, you know?
Well, I mean, the term's also being used more by sort of the edgy left now.
Yeah, yeah. And I've mixed feelings about that, because on the one hand, I find it a useful term. Like, somebody made an argument about why the Democrats couldn't do this or that procedural thing to get, you know, an important piece of legislation through. And they were like, well, but then the Republicans are going to do that. And I just wanted to say, dude, did your wife's boyfriend give you that argument? That's some cucked thinking. So, like, I like it, because, and I like it, you know, like calling someone who isn't rich, who has libertarian views, like they're a cuck for capitalism. I like it. But at the same time, I kind of recognize something in it. It reminds me of when I was younger. I don't know how kids talk now, but, you know, I'm 38. I grew up in the 90s, and, you know, homophobic like language was very common. You would call someone gay, not so much. Can I even say that on a podcast? I don't know. But, you know, people would talk like that. But now that, you know, that type of language is thankfully not acceptable in most circles, I do think there is a shift to this word cuck to denote a lesser man, a weaker man. You know, it never is literal. I mean, well, rarely is it literal, just the same way calling someone gay or wasn't literal. It was to say that you're weak, you're a lesser man, you're, you know, it was kind of a dominance move by someone who's actually insecure, which is how most dominance moves, I feel, are executed.
And I guess in approaching this, you sort of had to, well, first off, you yourself have said it's not really your kink.
Yeah.
But obviously you had to research this kink in writing the article. Maybe you could inform my listeners a little bit about what you found in looking at that sort of side of the kink community.
Yeah, it was interesting because, I mean, I had known a little bit about it from porn. I had seen some of the porn online, you know, I'm not going to. You know, it wasn't exactly my thing, but I was like, what is this? Like, how is this, you know? But obviously, in the same way that anything that's depicted in porn is not going to be like real life, I had a feeling that, like, okay, I doubt that the people who do this, if they do this, do it like this. And so I started looking on forums and things like that where people claim to, you know, do these things. But then when I looked at those, it was obvious that a lot of the guys were typing things with one hand. And a lot of the stories seem more like the fiction that the cuck fiction that I had read to research this. And so I was lucky enough to come across a podcast called the Keys and Anklets podcast. And that was really interesting because the guy who's in it, he's in the lifestyle. I guess that's the word they use for the swinger lifestyle, but I guess it also sometimes is used for the cuckolding and hot wife lifestyle. And cuckolding is, if cuckolding is like a spectrum, on like the less extreme end, you have hot wifing. And so like cuckolding, there's usually some element of like humiliation, like domination or something like that. Whereas hot wifing is just simply like, you know, a guy whose wife sleeps with other men and he enjoys it, and somehow he watches or he hears about it, or he generally is approving or encouraging.
Okay, that's interesting. I always thought the cuckold sort of fetish was always really more associated with just like being into like humiliation and sort of being degraded. But you're saying there's a wider sort of spectrum there.
Yeah. And apparently there are some guys even who like I guess on the really like further end away from like cuck, there's guys who call themselves stags to differentiate themselves from cucks. And they like, you know, they might even have some sort of like not competitive thing going on, but like they almost feel more virile because they have this attractive woman that other men sleep with, and
other men desire her.
Yeah, other men desire her, and then she goes home to him at the end of the day. And that was interesting to me. And well, one of the interesting things about the host of this show is he's a black man. He sleeps with other, you know, guys' wives. And he hosts this show, and just the way he talks about it was so different than like the porn I had seen. In the porn I had seen, like the cuck is always getting like, you know, like you said, like degraded and verbally or whatever. But his viewpoint of this was so different because he very much like, you know, and he interviews cucks, he interviews hot wives, and he interviews guys like him, they call bulls, guys who sleep with other people's wives. And
there's like a whole language to this.
Yeah, it's like a whole lingo. There's like a whole like lingo, and it's very interesting. And he was, you know, talked to bulls and stuff, and they, you know, when he interviews them, they're basically saying like, yo, these husbands are great. Like, instead of being, I call him like the anti Jesse Lee Peterson, for people who are familiar with that guy who is infamous for calling Ben Burgess a beta.
I mean, I feel like that's his catchphrase now.
Yeah.
Beta.
Yeah.
Beta.
I saw Ben Burgess this weekend actually at the Michael Brooks live show, and I was relaying some of this anecdote to him. But
not to go off into a tangent.
Yeah,
but I remember when I first came across Jesse Lee Peterson, and it was like years ago, because he's actually been doing this much longer than people realize. I was thinking to myself, he reminded me of a character from Boondocks.
Okay. Oh, I know what you're gonna say.
I just said, oh my god, Uncle Ruckus is like a real. There's a real person that's like that, and I was horrified.
Yeah, definitely he's got a definite Uncle Ruckus vibe for sure. Oh man. Yeah. But yeah, so the interesting thing about this guy is, you know, rather than calling these cocks, calling them betas, you know, he would say, oh man, these guys, like, they, it's all about them, and they're the ones who make this happen, and we should be so thankful that these guys are doing this. And like, even to the point where he's like, I see these couples together and I see the love that they have between them, and it's such a beautiful thing that they let me participate in it. And when I saw that, I was like, shit, I don't know anything about this. Like, this is something different. And I think there's a couple things that are interesting about his perspective. I think he's a pretty good interviewer, actually. And he's been doing it a long time, but I think it's interesting because he's kind of on both ends of it. He's a bull, but he's also in some sort of like dom relationship with a woman, and you know, she sleeps with other guys, and he's cool with that. So he kind of,
so she's the dom in the relationship.
Well, no, he's the dom in the relationship. Like, oh, okay, she, okay. She's he's referred to her as his slave. And so she'll sleep with other guys with his approval or with, I mean, maybe with his approval. I don't know the details of the relationship. But I guess the point I'm making is that, like, he's, you know, he's been on both ends of it. He's been someone who's sleeping with the, you know, with a wife, and somebody who has his, you know, close partner sleeping with other guys. So he brings an interesting perspective to it. And I, it's really been interesting because when you read something online, it could be, you know, it's the old New Yorker thing online. Nobody knows you're a dog, right? You don't know. And like, and most of the stuff is like made up. So it was interesting. Like, I feel like anybody who's willing to commit their voice to a podcast is way more believable than just like any forum you read, basically.
And I guess the other thing about this is reading the proposed article you were going to do that you're now making a video of. I guess this is actually a much more common kink than most people realize.
Yeah, apparently. I mean, I was surprised to find out that, what was it, like 58% of guys have some sort of like version of this, which, you know, again, with all the people calling other people cocks, like, you know, the lady doth protest too much, me thinks, you know, like they're throwing this around. But,
well, 58% are into it, and you have this contingent of men saying, you know, oh, this is horrible. You know, it's a few of them probably behind closed doors, you know, are into it too, I think.
Yeah, and to be honest, like, I mean, it's not something I'm into, but I get it. Like, I've been, you know, married for 8 years, been the same woman for 10 years. So I understand some of the dynamics that are at play here. And a lot of it comes from reading Sex at Dawn, which I think is a really important book. I had this interesting thing happen to me where I was, I'd read that book or was in the process of reading that book, and I watched the fourth season of The Sopranos, and that's the one where not only is Tony have, you know, his gumas, but Carmela is also actually like entertaining an affair with Furio, and you really get to see a lot of those dynamics that play out with the economics of marriage and monogamy and things like that. But one of the things that's interesting about this kink, and what I started to understand about it listening to this podcast, even though it is very much something that like the husbands get their wives into, it is something that I think women often get a lot out of. Like, you know, it's not talked about enough, but there's this book I read recently, Untrue by Wednesday Martin. She's been on Chris Ryan's podcast, and I think she wrote Primates of Park Avenue. But she talks about how like a lot of her conceptions about women's sexuality are just not correct. Like, there's this idea that like she points out the fact that there's a lot of studies that have been done recently that women actually struggle more with monogamy than men. Women kind of need more variety, or women need maybe not even necessarily more variety, but things get stale easier, where because of men's and women's different physiology, men are just kind of room to go, and women need something to get them going. And, you know, this whole thing made me understand. And the one thing that listening to this podcast and listening to these hot wives talk about is, you know, this is generally something I think that people get into when they're a little older, more like middle aged. And, you know, these women who maybe didn't feel sexy, or maybe because, yeah, their husbands tell them they're sexy, right?
I was just going to say, it's sort of like the whole swinger culture. You know, yeah. A lot of swingers are like more middle-aged.
Yeah.
Let's do a wife swap.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there is definitely like a desire like to kind of like rekindle things. And one thing that I heard, and I understand this, like if you're married and you married with kids, like, you know, women's like bodies take a hit if they have a kid. And then some people, because of maybe work or maybe just their relationship isn't doing well, things kind of drift apart, and they're, you know, whatever. And, you know, maybe your husband tells you you're really attractive all the time, but he always tells you you're really attractive. And so, like, in some ways, I think more than the figure of the cock, the hot wife, I actually think if you look at that, there's almost more going on there, because that's gives this woman a chance to like feel beautiful again, because, you know, it's not permissible really in certain ways to like for men to be giving a married woman a lot of attention. But sometimes that's kind of what you want, you know, because, you know, maybe you don't actually want it. Maybe you don't want to be, maybe most women don't want to be bothered with most guys, or maybe they want it to happen in the right context or whatever. But that's what I kind of found interesting, was this, you know, like this attempt to rekindle that and how people did that. And some of the other things that were talked about in Sex at Dawn that I think are relevant are like just women's different sexual responses in men. And like two of the things that I think from that book, before maybe we'll get over into the, like the economic things that I'm thinking about, but in terms of like sexual response, like women are more capable of, like the picture that's painted in that book is of women being able to have multiple partners more easily than men, just because, you know, men fire off and some women are still ready to go after that. And this is going to sound horrible. This is going to sound like Bernie Sanders, like, you know, early 70s thing that he wrote. But like, there's that potential there. Probably most women aren't going to be down for that, but there's more of a potential there, for that. And then, so that's why some women might like this idea of having, you know, more than one partner or whatever. And for men, like, it's what I've learned by like looking at Sex at Dawn and some of these other things, is this idea of sperm competition. And, you know, this idea that if a guy is watching his partner with another man, he like gets like super amped up. Because supposedly, and anytime I draw on anything close to evolutionary psychology, I'm really careful. But supposedly the idea is that he is, you know, creating more sperm so he can compete. And a lot of the competition that happens is happening like on the microscopic level. And so that's why like that, these guys that are into this, apparently the thing they like is like this mix of like excitement and jealousy. And that seems to be like, you know, what they crave, I think.
If we could back up just briefly for folks that may still be unfamiliar with Christopher Ryan's Sex at Dawn, or for people that just think, oh, this is a book by some professor that just wants to justify being a swinger. How would you respond to that criticism, or how would you summarize the book?
Yeah, I guess the way I would describe it is he takes a very questioning look at monogamy and suggests that maybe we're not totally, you know, automatically inclined to it. And I think the way he,
I think his term for it is what he's not necessarily talking about, like polygamy or polyamory. No. Even he uses the term monogamish. We're, yeah, monogamish. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's something, I think like the way he kind of, if I remember correctly, I think the way he starts off the book is by talking about like things that people in different cultures will and won't eat, and how like in some cultures bugs are just, yeah, these look great, they're delicious. And for most people it's like, ew. And what kind of sets off our disgust is so, you know, culturally dictated. And so like that is interesting. And I think a big part of it is just kind of showing that a lot of these practices or ideas we have about, you know, monogamy and relationships and things are very much cultural. And that sex is a bonding mechanism. It's how people create social bonds. And if you have, you know, and in some ways it makes sense. Like it's, you see it in a nuclear family where people are living together, at least in no small part because they're sleeping with each other, I would hope. And, you know, in more, you know, in hunter-gatherer societies, it's more amorphous. And and as is the child rearing, which is actually something that I find, you know, kind of the most interesting at reading that book, one of the most interesting things reading that book is hearing about the children that grow up in cultures where there isn't just like straight monogamy. Accounts from different cultures talked about how great it was because they, in these cultures where kind of things are a little more, where there's, you know, there's more than just monogamous pair bonds. People are much more open and like everybody's kids are everybody's kids and everybody's kind of taking care of each other. And, you know, look, there's something really like hippie and like appealing about that. I think that's something in some ways to be aspired to. And, my kind of thought is that, you know, if, in the same way that we move from hunter gatherer, which is a very communal type of arrangement, and both in terms of resources and sharing partners, then we moved slowly to agriculture, which is, you know, much more locked down, where you have monogamy and you have property that is, you know, cordoned off and things. And then you move to an industrial model where the families are even smaller and the property is even more cordoned off and sectioned off. And then, okay, well, what happens if we move towards socialism? Socialism in many ways is trying to recapture that communal aspect you have in a hunter-gatherer society. Would that also apply to sexual relations? And I think that's kind of an anxiety that is underlying some of the apprehension about these things. You see it, and which is kind of, there's some support for this and just the idea that like in social democracies or socialist countries or however you want to describe them, don't want to get too much into that semantic argument, but there's the book, Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism. And, you know, the family structure really changes if you have a strong welfare state. And, you know, it creates greater autonomy for women and more possibility for some of these arrangements if everything isn't tied to this specific nuclear family male breadwinner model.
Yeah, I'm just going to add two things to that. First, with regards to Sex at Dawn, what I found most interesting about that book was the way he tackles sex as being sort of a mechanism for social bonding. Mm-hmm. Because I've always found it interesting. I don't know many people that think of sex being that bonding mechanism. Most people I know will say things like, it's just pleasurable, it's like a hedonistic activity. Or they'll say, like, sex is just for procreation. It's just biological procreation, and that's it. And I don't really think that's the case, but maybe that's because I think about things more socially. I've always found that interesting that more people haven't looked at it as a social bonding mechanism.
Yeah, indeed. You said you had two things you wanted to say.
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to say was the nuclear family is very interesting because I think there are like pros and cons to it. I think we all grow up in a society and are socialized to want, the wife and the 2.5 kids. But, you know, families that operate in like an extended form, there's advantages to that. Like an extended family, they can divide up the labor. Thaddeus Russell actually talks about this a lot. And I find it interesting that so few are willing to question the nuclear family or maybe critique it in some way.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, like I said, I've got a nuclear family. I literally have the assuming that the 0.5 is my dog. I have the 2.5 kids and the house in the suburbs or exurbs or whatever you want to call it. And I love it. I mean, you know, it's great. It, you know, there's a lot. But I also feel like it's harder and harder, especially in like the current economy, to make it work. And you know, there's more demands to work. There's, you know, you're less able to have somebody who is, I write and do YouTube, but my main job is a stay at home dad. And so there's less and less ability to do that because more and more people need to work and work and work. But I do think that, you know, part of it is part of it is that I feel like the nuclear family is, in some ways, it's the object up for sale in our society that we kind of aspire to, that we put away cash to get, kind of, if that makes sense. It's the model we aspire to. And so it has a lot of things that people want, but it's not necessarily the best way to get that. So, you know, you want, let's say you want, you know, you want companionship, and that includes, you know, emotional and intellectual support, but also sex. And maybe you want kids, which is a part of it. Or maybe you just want to be around children. Children are nice to be around. They kind of, you know, they lighten the mood, even if they can drive you a little crazy at sometimes. So I think people want access to those things. Those things are good for adults to have, you know, and people want to participate in the raising of children in one way or another. But the idea that the standard model needs to be everybody, you know, having their own home there where, you know, one or two people works and, you know, like that it's that it has to be exactly that. I think there's a lot of questions about that. And I think, you know, one of the things for me, especially, that makes me question that is, you know, now that, you know, LGBT folks are, you know, have more and more rights and are able to be much more accepted in society, you see the kind of families they've created for themselves, whether they are, you know, whether they are more of like a monogamous setup or whether they're more of kind of a extended setup. You know, I know gay men who have like kind of extended things going on where it's a little more, you know, it doesn't follow that model. And I think it kind of is making some straight people say, huh, maybe we could tweak this.
Well, getting back around to this kink of the cuck, I think most of the writing dealing with the sort of surging popularity of the term as a slur, most of the writing on it has focused on how the alt-right uses it and how, you know, in general, cuck porn has a tendency to be interracial. So there's, you know, the white woman going with the big black bull, and the husband or the boyfriend hides in the corner. And, oh, this sort of explains why the alt-right would use it, because they have all these racially based anxieties. But your article and the upcoming video, I think you think there's even more to this term and the way it's used, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do think that... I think there's a little more going on. It's kind of what I've been talking about. I'm trying to think like what else more there is to it besides. Yeah, I think there's a lot of economic anxiety. I think that it's interesting that, you know, I often wonder why certain cultural ideas and economic ideas get pegged as left and right, when it doesn't always seem there's a connection. It could be arbitrary. There could be things that, you know, especially since people's political alignments are kind of all over the place, when you meet an actual individual and not somebody that is like, you know, being manufactured as a potential swing voter or something. But I kind of wonder, like, well, why, you know, why? Why is there this association with, let's say, for example, like, you know, why is the right so down with like this traditional family structure and so get so triggered and fearful at the idea of like cuckoldry? And why are they at the same time, you know, like big militaries and, you know, not like social welfare programs and things like that. I think there is like a desire to, or there is a fear of like losing, you know, there's this fear of losing whatever kind of safety or comfort that they have. And I think really at the end of the day, I think the fear is, and this is probably the best way to put this, is The fear isn't that they're going to get cucked. The fear – that's not actually the fear. I think the fear at the end of the day is that they have it actually worse than any cuck has it. You know, they if I think about some of these like incels or like alt-right guys whose wives probably never fucked them because they're insufferable. When I think about some of these guys, I think they probably have it worse than the cucks. I think they have it certainly worse than the
– Well, they sound – I was going to say they sound much more consumed by, you know, a sense of shame than the people that appeared on that podcast you mentioned.
Yeah. And so like these guys, like they're afraid of being cucked. It's something they're it's something they're afraid of. And meanwhile, like I would major that these guys on this podcast that I've heard, they definitely have more intimacy with their wives. And probably the ones who like aren't like hardcore cucks, I would say they have more sex than a lot of these alt-right guys. And I think that's what they're really afraid of. I think that what they're really afraid of is that deep down they know, both in a sexual sense and an economic sense, they have it just worse. There. And I think it would be the same thing if you instituted some type of, you know, social democracy or socialism. Again, don't want to get into that little sidetrack, but like, I think they would be better off economically. I think these guys would be better off in a situation where you know, like women took more than one husband. I think these guys would they'd probably have better sex lives, and if not, they would probably have more intimacy. Like one of the things that is popular in the cuckoldry world is like chastity devices. So some of the cocks aren't getting laid much or at all, or I don't know, but you know, so those guys definitely, maybe the alt-right guys are fucking more than them, but it seems to me, just listening to these podcasts, is even though if they're not maybe having as much sex as these guys, there's a connection there. Like their wife is interested enough in them to lock them in a fucking cage. You know what I mean? Whereas like some of these guys that are, or, you know, or an incel, someone who can't even get laid, like doesn't even have anyone like that. And I think that's what these guys are afraid of, is that deep down they know that they'd be better off as cucks.
And with regards to the economic angle, can we get into that a little bit more?
Yeah. And so in that book, Untrue by Wednesday Martin, she talks about some of the – I wish I had it up in front of me, but she talks about some of the cultural and social economic aspects that make – polygyny, you know, women having more than one husband, that make that desirable or make that work in a society. And some of those things are like things we have in this society where, you know, men, I really wish I had the exact thing up in front of me, but point it, the whole idea is that whenever you have a situation where you have a lot of men who are doing poorly economically, it could be beneficial to have, you know, a situation where women take more than one husband. Well, to say nothing of how that would actually work in our culture and how people would actually, if they would want to go for it, is another story altogether. But, there is something, you know, and I thought about this like a month or two ago, because there was a article about a woman who was in a polyamorous relationship with like three or four guys. I think at least two of them were living in the same house, and she was pregnant and they were going to raise a child together. And I was just like, oh, that's nice. Like, that's nice. There's that kid there. Those people are going to have a lot of support. Like they're going to, you know, it's going to be, if she wants to go out on a date with the, you know, one of the fathers, I mean, obviously they know who the biological father is, I believe, but if she wants to go on a date with him, they have childcare. They maybe pool their resources so they have a nice, comfortable home. And so that, I don't know, something about that seems nice. I mean, it would be nice if we didn't have to arrange ourselves based on that. And I think that's actually part of the difficulty of monogamy. Monogamy, people getting stuck in monogamy, people get stuck in monogamous relationships oftentimes because their partner is supporting them, or they're getting healthcare through their job, or whatever. And it would be nice if that were not the case.
Yeah, I think too, there's been, as you point out in this article, there's been so many economic and social changes that this sort of leave it to beaver type family idea that a lot of these alt-right kids sort of aspire to, it's just not even feasible. You know, the jobs aren't there. You really can't have just one person working anymore, or, you know, just less. That's less of a thing now. The whole sort of way we do things is very far removed from the 1950s. And beyond that, you know, this image of the Leave It to Beaver family, it's sort of out of a TV show. It may not even be the reality of that era.
Yeah, and I think it probably, I mean, if I had to guess, I would say it's probably not the reality, probably wasn't the reality of that era, although I don't have, you know, demographic numbers or whatever. But I would guess that there was a lot of people who weren't living like that and looked at that and thought that was bullshit. And, you know, there's this one of the things that, you know, Ryan and Jetha talk about in Sex at Dawn is this idea of Flintstonization. This kind of an evolutionary, so that evolutionary psychologists do all the time, which is they look back at the distant past through the lens of like today, usually, but oftentimes like 1950s world. And so you get, that's how you get the Flintstones. You know, you get, you know, people like living in a nuclear family in the Stone Age, you know, which is about as close to reality as them having, you know, birds for household appliances and dinosaurs for transportation and whatnot. You know, it's kind of ridiculous.
Well, I think another aspect of this article I wanted to touch on before we start wrapping up is, you know, obviously the article is dealing with the fears of heterosexual men and some of the changes that may be causing those fears to arise culturally, but you're also very adamant about saying, essentially, you're not trying to play the world's smallest violin for these men either.
Yeah, I mean, look, like, I think we should have sympathy for everyone, even if, you know, no matter what. But like, yeah, I don't want to play the smallest violin in the world for straight men. You know, they, I mean, come on, straight white men, especially, or a lottery, all things considered, when that happens. But still, like, you have to admit, as you were saying before, that you can't support a family on one income anymore, which makes the whole, you know, which makes the whole idea of, you know, a single male breadwinner just kind of obsolete. And it takes away a power that men had. Now, I don't think that's a power that, you know, anybody should have really had. But at the same time, you have to admit that kind of throw, you know, that's a change in what you're, you know, expected, and what it's expected that you can attain, that men have to readjust to at the very least. It's not to say that, like, oh, feel so bad for these, you know, these straight white guys. I mean, we've benefited from changes in the culture and et cetera as much as anybody else. Well, maybe not as much as anybody else, but, you know, we've benefited from a change in sexual mores as much as anyone. And so, like, yeah, it's benefited straight men as well. It's just we take a little bit of a hit, even if some of it is just a perceived hit, right? And, you know, that...
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, like, you know, like, there is definitely an extent to which the change is real, you know, in an economic sense, you know, where you could be someone who just had a high school diploma and you could work on the assembly line and you could, you know, support a family. Maybe that wasn't open to you depending on your race and other factors, but generally, and now you can't do that. Now you go into debt for a, you know, a bachelor's degree or even a master's degree, and you can't get work that is going to support a family. And so that's not insignificant. That's legit. I mean, that's, everybody's experiencing it. It's not just on them, but it's kind of like, you know, it's like now kind of straight white guys are more likely to have to deal with what everyone else is dealing with, despite still holding quite a bit of privilege.
And another thing I wanted to touch on, and I'm not sure you're going to touch upon this in the video, but when we're talking about these kinks, in particular, something like cuckoldry, and also I guess we could apply this to porn as well. The alt-right may have focused on this because of their weird, like, racial white supremacist, you know, paranoia. At the same time, I think there can even be a racist element in some of these kinks.
Yeah, for sure. Well, one of the things I, you know, kind of found interesting about listening to the Keys and Anklets podcast, is the name of the podcast, is, you know, he talks about obviously being a black man and, you know, really experiencing it, you know, not wanting to judge people, but I don't know, like basically saying that he gets that some of what's going on in some of these things where people particularly have a fetish for black men, sometimes it is, I've heard in other places reported that, like, for example, in the South, the interracial cuckolding is more popular. I forget the exact source for that, so maybe I don't know how much stock I want to put in it. But one of the things that the host of the show, Michael C., was saying was that he seemed a little bit more comfortable than I am with the use of certain words while play or sex or whatever is going on. And like I'm very uncomfortable with the N-word. I don't want to hear that. But he kind of, in referencing it being used, he was just kind of like, well, you know, like in the right context, it's with the right people, who are respectful of me or whatever, I'll, you know, do it. He didn't say that explicitly, but in regards to that word, but he's kind of hinted at things like that. And, you know, whatever, to each to their own. But he's also pointed out that in this kink, you know, there's probably like there's an objectification of black men, you know, as like literally just being like nothing but big cocks, you know, which is, you know, really objectifying. It's treating them as just like a body. But they're on the other end of it. One thing that he points out is, just the amount of like white guilt that he can kind of feel latent in some of the people who are into this, you know. And he talked about like the first time, you know, and some of it might be performative and twisted and like more not actually coming from the right place, you know. But still, he said, like, you know, like there's obviously a lot of white guilt in here. You can totally see it. And that is interesting, you know, and it obviously, I mean, it's tied in with our nation's, you know, history of racism and, you know, like what has been done to black men in this country. You know, I think he even mentioned Emmett Till on an episode of one of his podcasts, basically saying like, yeah, you know, this guy got killed for like looking at a white woman or supposedly looking at a white woman, you know. So that's there. I mean, that's kind of like in our history, and it's kind of, that's kind of undeniable. You know, that's always been that thing, like, oh, they're, you know, they're coming to take your women, and that whole like scare thing.
I think it's interesting because I think with some of these kinks where there's this uncomfortable racist element, I kind of wonder if these kinks would exist in a very different world, in a society that was modeled and organized differently. You mentioned that the title of that podcast is Keys and Anklets, right?
Yeah.
Well, so it still references back to the sort of property angle of the modern relationship. It's not really broken free of that. And I kind of wonder what would happen to these kinks in a society that was radically transformed and more egalitarian, where the hierarchies are more flattened.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one thing that really blew my mind or changed my idea of this or perspective or whatever was learning about cuckolding in the gay community, which kind of surprised me, because when I read about this, I think it was in Dan Savage's blog or somewhere like that. I don't know, the most of the gay men that I know, or a lot of them anyway, my younger brother's gay, so I know like some gay men, they're in monogamous relationships, right? There is some sort of like, you know, flexibility where even if you're have a boyfriend or a husband, you know, things aren't. But recently, very recently, cuckolding has become a fetish in the gay community. And so the conjecture that I hear, again, it's just conjecture, is that since gay marriage is now a thing and there is that kind of property relationship that people have moved into, that there is now this fetishization of moving outside of it somehow. And so, yeah, I think like, to your point, like we're very influenced by our culture, and a different culture would probably produce very, very different fetishes.
Well, I guess closing out, what do you think the main thing that you hope people get out of not only this episode, but the upcoming video that you'll be publishing on this topic?
I guess the thing that I would like people to get out of it is to examine their own insecurities and conceptions about monogamy and sexuality, even if you're not planning on stepping outside of it. I mean, I have no desire to step outside of it. I'm happy where I am and stuff. But just to kind of entertain the idea that, like I said, like, you know, not every society enjoys the same things, and that human beings are a little more flexible. And maybe, you know, maybe especially if, you know, you're younger or whatever, or you're in a situation where your life is in flux and you've had some sort of relationship or economic or whatever else kind of change, maybe that you're going to try and find something that works best for you. And maybe that's not even one of the established models of consensual non-monogamy that we have, or you know, or maybe it's, you know, not something you've put a label on. Maybe you're just going to try and work outside of that. I would like people to just think about these things and, and just, you know, think about the language that we use and in regards to them.
And I guess in closing too, I wanted to ask, or maybe quote, from this unpublished article. You write, "The anxiety about this shift that we hear coming the most loudly from the far right looks like a fear of losing what we have or had. In other words, the nuclear family. Yes, they fear getting cucked. But I think the fear goes deeper. I think deep down they fear that they have it worse than any cuck." Maybe we could revisit that, because you mentioned that angle a little bit earlier, and I wanted to delve into it, but I didn't really know where to go with it. Do you think it's just a matter of they feel as if they can't have intimacy because, you know, women are less willing to put up with their bullshit? What is it that they have worse?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, maybe it is they can't have intimacy because women aren't looking to put up with their bullshit. I think there is this idea that, you know, once you get something locked down, once you've corralled off the land and, you know, claimed it as your property, it's yours. But then there's something sclerotic about that. There's something like really, really dead about that. And that can, you know, that type of the desire to like hold on to something and say mine can actually kind of squash passion if you're not really mindful. And that to make it not squash the passion, I mean, like any relationship is work. I think that when you get married or find a monogamous partner, especially amongst guys, I think there is this tendency to think, okay, I got that covered. I have a partner. I have someone who's going to be with me all the time. I have someone who will want to have sex with me all the time. And I always hear
guys say that they're, I mean, I kind of find it cringe when I hear like young men say this, but I've heard more than one young man say like their idea of a perfect relationship is a woman who will suck them off like every day after they get home from work. And I'm like, that's not how relationships work. Women are not Stepford Wives robots.
Yeah, you better be ready to reciprocate, buddy. but like, yeah, you know, and I think that kind of mentality is very to like look at this as a piece of property that is to be acquired. I think if you look at it like that, you're gonna have less sex. Because I think that type of approach to things, I think that's a passion killer if you're looking at.
Well, I mean, it's also dehumanizing to your partner.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, totally. Totally. Like, you're, you know, and so I think that, yeah, they're not. And, like, look, I don't doubt that even though there's guys that are just like, I want a girl to suck me off after, you know, my day at work, I would wager that though they might not be in touch with their feelings enough, they actually need more than that. And so, yeah, they're not going to be happy even if they get what they want, you know, or whatever. Like, I don't think there's many women who are just going to take that role, but I think a lot of guys actually wouldn't be happy with that. I think a lot of people don't know what we want. And I think that's another thing to take away is that we kind of don't realize the social like needs that we have. You know, we maybe think too much in this one particular model, and maybe we should start thinking, well, okay, what kind of emotional needs do I have? Are those going to be fulfilled in a marriage? Maybe I'd be better off, you know, just being a bachelor or being a, you know, whatever. Hey, maybe you're better off being a bull. I don't know. I think there is a degree to which, and I include myself in this. Like I love my nuclear family. I think it's great, but hey, maybe we'd all be better off if I, you know, didn't in some way, in a very, you know, just in the way that monogamy in general, if I didn't have such a property thing where I, you know, was like, don't stay away from my wife, you know, maybe we'd all be better off if we were all just a little bit more relaxed about that. I don't know. Maybe I'm, you know, just as, I have just as much cuck fear as anyone else. I don't know.
And also, I just thought of this as well. You point to in the article how your perception of this whole cuck subculture changed after listening to the Keys and Anklets podcast. Maybe you could talk just really briefly about the difference between sort of what we're told sex is like in pornography and the reality of things.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just the, like, the thing that really just kind of I didn't understand, which is how how even I guess in the situations where the guys were like more on the cuck end of the spectrum, I guess I just didn't realize, you know, like that these people are just people. Like, you listen to one of these podcasts about you know, this lifestyle or like a swinger lifestyle, and it's almost like it almost becomes boring after you've listened to a couple episodes.
Like it's actually more mundane than people would realize.
Yeah, it's just like, and the cliche that I feel like you hear from these people over and over again is communication. Our communication got so much better. We got so much better at communicating, and that's interesting. Like, I find that interesting because I think any like long-term relationship, you have to communicate. And so like, I, I don't necessarily think I ever thought these people had unhealthy relationships. And I'm sure that, you know, like anything else, the demographics are all over the place. Some people are in healthy ones, some people are in unhealthy ones. But I definitely get the impression that, like, when the people who do this, they develop good communication skills, because you have to say, well, I'm okay with this, but I'm not okay with this. And okay, before you do this, let's talk about this. And oh, you know, and everyone has, you know, there's no one size fits all. Everyone has different ways they go about it. Some people have lots of rules. Some people don't have lots of rules. Some people start off with rules. And, you know, you hear these people talk about this and it's like they're talking about anything else. You know, they're, you know, talking about, oh, you know, how they're finding a bull, and they're talking about how they got into it, and it just seems very mundane. They seem like normal kind of people, and, you know, it just doesn't seem odd to me anymore. I mean, it seems a little odd, but it's much more, I don't know. I definitely came away from it realizing that it wasn't what I thought it was. Like, it's almost there's definitely a relationship thing going on there in addition to this sexual aspect. Just the way
it sounds like it all requires a degree of trust between all the consenting groups.
Yeah, it definitely seems like that. I mean,
it also, the other thing is, you know, I'm sure these alt-right guys would look at, you know, these guys that are, like, openly into it, and we'll talk about it on a podcast like the Keys and Anklets podcast, and say, oh, they're so beta. But, like, if you're that open about it and you're that comfortable with yourself, like, in a way, that's the most alpha thing you can be, is, like, no, yeah. I just don't care.
Exactly.
I hate the whole alpha, beta bullshit anyways, but it's just kind of weird, because I guess what I'm saying is, it takes a lot of balls to be like, no, I'm openly into this.
Yeah, exactly. And look, I mean, those guys are obviously, they're not completely out, you know, they're usually like some sort of, they don't use their full names or whatever, but still, like, even that, like, yeah, I mean, when I listen to those guys, I'm kind of like, I don't have the balls to do that. Like, no way, man. Like, I kind of feel that maybe the cucks are the best amongst us. I couldn't do that. I'm not that secure.
Well, I have to say, I think this whole conversation is definitely going to be a parallax view for a lot of my listeners.
Yeah, that.
Well, Greg, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. Any remarks you want to give in closing, how people can look up your work?
Rebel Base YouTube channel. You can follow me on Twitter at Greg M. Belvedere. Rebel Base YouTube channel, though. If you like this conversation, I really try and bring a lot of the same analysis to it. I talk about eco-socialism, the occult, psychedelics, all sorts of good stuff. So, media, technology. So please check it out. That's like my bread and butter right there. Thank you very much for having me, JJ.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Check out Greg Belvedere's YouTube channel, Rebel Base, if you enjoyed our conversation. He will be posting a video related to this conversation in the near future. And, of course, you can always drop me a line letting me know what you thought of our discussion in this episode. You can do that on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. As always, if you enjoy the content of Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on Twitter, where you can hear archived editions of the program, as well as the Parallax Views current events program of the week that was, with my pal Casey. That's where you can get all the hot takes, folks. And also, we have a new experimental project that we just started, a movie commentary podcast, Casey and I's first venture into this genre. Is actually appropriate for the holidays. It's the movie My Bloody Valentine, the slasher from 1981. So, if you're a fan of Parallax Views, check that out on the Parallax Views Patreon page. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.